Good morning, Rick, and welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on March 4th, 2025, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PC Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Altamirano Crosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, our Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. At this time, I will say the flag salute, and you may join me if you wish.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic which stands, nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
I have none.
Comments from the public is item two on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and persons shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located at the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial *9 at my phone. I'll call on you to speak at the appropriate time. If you've called in on a phone, please dial *6 to unmute yourself. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state your name, and indicate where you're from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or other materials to enter into the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk, who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought forward for discussion. So first up, item one, recognitions and declarations. Our favorite thing to do is employee of the month. And today's employee for March is J.D. Daniel. I will introduce Casey Dalbeck to introduce J.D. Good morning.
Good morning, commissioners.
You know, he looks like he's standing outside the principal's
office. Sorry about that. I got a smile.
Right, not a trouble.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Casey Dalbeck, and I am the East County Operations Superintendent. I am so excited to have the opportunity to tell you about the March Employee of the Month, J.D. Daniel. J.D. kicked off his career at Snohomish PUD on May 12, 1992, as an apprentice lineman. For the next 4 years, he climbed the ranks through the journeyman line apprenticeship, and by January 1996, J.D. had earned a promotion to journeyman lineman. Over the next few years, J.D. took on several temporary positions, including journeyman lineman in charge, underground services, line foreman, and outside service lineman. These roles highlighted his strong support for his colleagues and his leadership skills. In 2014, J.D. accepted the permanent position of line foreman, and in May of 2017, he transitioned to an outside service lineman. Most recently, in 2024, he was promoted to line construction general foreman, a position he still holds today. As East County's general foreman, J.D. continues to work selflessly and hard every day to make everyone else successful, taking no gratitude for himself. In fact, this honor alone is probably turning J.D.'s face bright red right now. Humility is just part of his charm. This is why J.D. is the perfect employee of the month. He simply wants our employees to be successful and our customers taken care of safely and efficiently. J.D. shows this most recently during the bomb cyclone that hit the East County area last November. East County was hit particularly hard, and we were hearing reports of from servicemen of one area, Lake Rossiger, potentially taking up to a month to restore power to. Hearing this challenge, J.D. willingly stepped up to lead a new concept that the district was thinking about, where we would assign the general foreman 4 mutual aid crews with the area and circus to restore and focus on. J.D. was so successful with this new concept that by the time it was all done, he had 9 mutual aid crews, a staging location for materials that he worked one-on-one with the fire district to obtain, and restored power to the area in 4 days, saving invaluable time and money for the district and its customers. His swift and efficient work restored power quickly, earning gratitude from customers and admiration from peers. His skill and dedication to the community he serves and the team he leads is a testament to the type of employee we all strive for and to be. Judy, my applause echoes for you today and every day. Thank you for your unwavering commitment to the team and your community.
For a picture.
Thank you for being part of Morgan. Thank you.
Go ahead, boss.
Bossy.
Well, I'll start then. Thank you so much, JD. I mean, you read a write-up like that, and that's just phenomenal that one person can have such a huge impact on what sounds like an incredibly challenging restoration. So, and you look around this room, I think this is the most people we've ever had in this room. We've never been able to get this many people happy or angry at us. Look what you've accomplished. They're all here for you. And that's really a testament to your leadership and how you're a member and a team member. Thank you for your.
It's a team. It ain't all me, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. You know, you're only as good as those that were.
I've worked with some great people through my whole career.
Yeah. So. Oh, you have? 30 oh, yeah. years. 30 years. 30, that's cool. 30
this spring.
Yeah. You're not going anywhere, are you? I love it.
Awkward.
As soon as possible. I'll see that right there.
The write-up, you know, I have a little background on the operations side of the house, and mutual aid crews, that adds a whole nother complexity in terms of your scheduling, because you're dealing with units that really may not even know about how our system.
Yeah.
And so based on my understanding of how it works, that and it's a whole other level of complexity, and really commend it.
We made sure to make time that the each foreman that came up.
Yeah.
They showed their open points. Everything was all safe.
Yeah. Well, congratulations! And you came up through the apprentice program. I love it. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. I want to say thank you so much for your hard work, dedication, and leadership. And I echo the words the President Sid Logan and Commissioner Tony. I'm new here, but I can see how, I mean, all this energy and how all the team efforts and nothing better than beauty.
Absolutely.
Yes. Thank you so much. And I'm the messenger only, okay?
Just
the
messenger.
I think you can miss 1-0 here, but I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm new here too, so idea. But I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I get the picture.
Those are my grandbabies.
Oh, you're going to love this. You are just going to love it.
Really nice picture.
Well, JD, I don't know if you have a trophy case.
No,
but now you can go build one. Your trophy. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So JD, do you have someone here you'd like to introduce, or
I see a real pretty lady there.
Very pretty lady. It gets the heat off me. This is Shamar, my girlfriend.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Nice to. Oh, wow. You are.
Nice to meet you.
Why don't we? Do you two want to have a picture and then we'll step back in?
Okay. That sounds good.
Maybe. Oh, thank you. Yeah, Sydney's over here.
We'll
step out
and let them do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Smile.
Christmas
card picture.
Oh, yeah. Postmark.
Red and green.
If you'll step back in, we'll get another picture. Thank you.
But wait, there's more.
There's more. There's always more.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I had the opportunity to meet JD pretty early on, and I think you were a foreman out in Monroe when I joined the PUD, and you can tell right off the bat, phenomenal leader, really cared deeply, and have watched his leadership really have a huge impact on not just operations, but the overall district. And then I had the pleasure, probably was not a pleasure for JD, but the last day or two of the restoration for the bomb cyclone, I got to go tag along with JD for a couple hours and kind of see how he managed that area. And again, just impressed beyond belief on how he had, first and foremost, kept, I don't know how many crews that you had, you were with mutual assistance, our own folks. There was a chunk of resources and people out there. JD did a phenomenal job keeping them safe. And the restoration effort, I mean, again, you all, many of you saw pictures from the damage that was done. It was incredible. And JD, really, his leadership is what helped us effectively and safely restore that area. So just a huge kudos to everything that you've done for the district.
They had lots of help out there. Andy in the pole yard, he was right on the spot. Sue in the warehouse, she was awesome.
Yeah, it was
fun.
JD, we always give the opportunity for the employee of the month to have the microphone and say, can he choose 10, 15 minutes?
I'll defer that to the next employee of the month. Yeah.
Does anyone like in the audience have a message for JD? I'm looking for humor.
But in all seriousness, JD, thank you so much for what you and all these other people in the room do to keep our customers up front. It's huge. It's a huge challenge. And that storm was just crazy. It was like toothpicks had been dropped from the sky. And so
all these guys out here that put it all back together.
Yeah.
Well, great teams also have great leaders. So thank you for being a great leader.
Thank you.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you.
Bear.
We can escape.
That's right.
We got things to do.
Oh, 2 minutes to.
Cheers now.
How can I?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Just in case.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
I was going to say, support each other, yeah.
It was really cool. Item two, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? Please state your first and last name for the record. I'm not seeing any hands up in the room. No sign-up cards, and I don't see the one online. Move on to item three, our consent agenda. 3A, approval of the minutes of the regular meeting of February 18, 2025. Bid award, professional service contracts and amendments, and consideration of certification / ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion. Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? Please raise your hand. Any comments? Or hands raised online. Commissioners, do you have any questions or?
I have none.
Commissioner Olson?
20 seconds.
Okay.
just in general, I don't have questions, but Penn staff has done a great job of some of these are amendments and doing a great job of holding the line on multiple future years CPI increases. That's good negotiating.
So I have a question on an observation on it's one on page 17. It's the electronic payment services, processing services, the amendment for $17 million some dollars. I'm just trying to understand, are these the credit card fees? Is that the main cost of this? Or these numbers are staggering.
Lines direct contracts and purchasing. We have Patricia here. She can give you the details on that.
I'm Patricia Farley with Customer Accounting. And the fees on this one are proportionate for what we pay on the back end for processing. So the majority of these costs are coming from Visa, MasterCard, and pass through to us. Chase Payment Tech.
Approximately, is there an average percentage that we're paying?
It's a really big matrix. Of how the costs get broken out, depending on what type of card you use. So it depends on the brand, including debits and credits. We have an average cost for transaction that is currently at about 85 cents.
Thank you.
And based on an annual increase of 15%.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, it's being driven by others. Okay.
And I assume taking credit cards helps ensure that we get paid. And that's see head nods in the audience. Lots of stuff. Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments, commissioners? Okay, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carried unanimously. Next, our item four, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and our CEO to discuss issues among ourselves with team staff. I'll introduce our CEO, John. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. So before we get into our media and other regular updates, I want to introduce our new CFO, Jeff Bishop. Jeff comes from us, from Omaha Public Power District, but he is kind of a Northwest native, and I think that's in large part what brought him back to us or back here this way. But super glad that Jeff is here and glad that he's going to be a part of Team PUD. He started yesterday, so
wow,
we'll be drilling with as many questions. Oh, right? That was your cue. She's
excited to work with you. MMS has a phenomenal track record. I appreciate John and the team. It's a great organization. I met with the finance team for the first time yesterday. Scott left me in great hands with the great finance leaders we've got. And there's, I reflect on the work that I've seen John do from the LPC perspective, focus on public power. And just know that you've got a phenomenal leader, a phenomenal group of leaders at the PUD as well as employees. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to work with you.
Well, welcome. You started just at the right time because the weather's only going to get better.
All right. Next up is our media update and Aaron Swaney. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, commissioners. Aaron Swaney, lead communications specialist. Happy to be here this morning. So just a media report for February. Started off with a little storm coverage. Just at the end of February, we had a little storm blow in. Again, I kind of want to highlight just, we get calls all the time from media. Got to respond to them. ECC, Scott Sutton, the group, Aaron Janisco and Paul Kiss, all were just, as usual, fantastic in getting the information, hunting stuff down. This was 24-hour storm, but they did a great job. So I couldn't do my job without them. Rate increase coverage we had kind of everywhere. Had in small publications, had it on TV, Herald, Seattle Times, kind of just a lot of different coverage for the rate increase. I think our main messages were, you know, it was going to be in the base charge, so it was going to be pretty stable for our customers. Also, that it was really due to the severe weather events that we experienced in 2024. So those are the main messages we're giving out. I'm sure you've heard of this, BPA job cuts is big in the news. Obviously, as BPA's single largest customer, we've got a few media inquiries on this. So far, we've really provided the statement that we're deeply concerned with these cuts. You know, that we don't see the effects right now, but these impacts could be great on reliability and affordability and all these things. So right now, we're being a little reactive. That may change to being a little more proactive in our approach to this. So we'll come on that for sure.
And I'll just mention, of course, Julieta and Sid were a part of the conversations that we had in D.C. Last week, and hearing straight from a couple of our delegation members. And we are working on a strategy, Kim and team, on how do we play offense in this kind of in this space and do it effectively and in a way that doesn't just kind of cry wolf, but actually brings data and brings valuable information that that we want the right folks to hear. So we're working on that.
And this is Seattle Times had a good piece yesterday.
Yeah. Saw that.
And I do hope that proactive part of it, we may need to pull in support from outside of the utility industry.
Some miscellaneous media coverage. So press releases on our brand new leadership, Amy Carstens and Jeff Bishop. So new CEO, CFO. This went out to trade press. So APPA and the BPA, this press release up. And great to be able to kind of highlight changes in leadership. We had some media coverage on the RV fire where we had our own folks really jump up and into a really dangerous situation to get a body out of an RV. And it was a very scary situation. So got a little bit of coverage on that. We were mentioned as the kind of the first responders on the scene. And then finally, Jeff Feinberg worked with Chartwell on a study that they published on our kind of how we self-attested for the CCA, all the bill credits that we were giving out. It was a pretty unique way that we self-attested for customers to make sure that we knew what their income was. So it was a good article. Publications, we had a nice write-up in the NWPPA Bulletin on our wildfire mitigation. David Popich, Angela Johnston all helped write this story. So it was a nice chance for us to talk about where we're at with this process. Also worked with Schland to kind of compare and contrast where we are in the industry. I just wanted to highlight this. We've got a nice ad for our Energy Block Party coming up in April. In the Inside Linwood newsletter. And then finally, our My Snowpod app has been getting some pub lately. We wrote our actually Herald column for February was on the app. You'll see the March Wire really focuses on the app and all the really great benefits that are there. And then unfortunately, this won't play, but we were actually called out by this podcast. It was a sports podcast in Seattle. And he literally just goes on and says, I love my new PUD app. And I think it's just because he just got his advanced meter. So he's able to check all the usage. And I wish it would play because I can't do it justice. But he's talking about his kids and how, oh, these kids got to turn all the lights out and everything. It was really good. At the end, he just says, thank you, PUD, and I love this app. So if you got 2 minutes, you know, listen to it after.
That's wonderful.
And that's all for me.
Maybe someone can get the link to Allison.
It's actually on the, you can click it in the presentation. Oh. It just won't play. It was all set up to play and it just,
got it.
For some reason it's not, there's a playback problem.
Thank you. Okay. Any questions for us? Thank you.
Good job, Aaron. Thank you. All right. Next up is our legislative report. Ryan Collins. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, Ryan Collins, the District State Government and External Affairs Specialist 3, and I am here again today to present on our key legislation report. The purpose of this presentation is to report on key state legislation for the commission. As always, I'd love time at the end of this report to for questions, but feel free to jump in at any time and stop me. We're officially through week 7 of the 2025 legislative session, which means we're about halfway through. Or in other words, counting backwards from the end of session, that means we're 54 days from when sine die, which is the official term for the end of session, happens. Since my last report, we passed 2 major bill cutoff deadlines. The policy cutoff on February 21st, when bills need to be passed out of their policy committees to continue to be considered, as well as the fiscal cutoff this past Friday on February 28th, when bills had to be passed out of their fiscal committees to remain alive. Prior to the policy cutoff, over 1,900 bills were introduced between the two chambers. While more bills will still be introduced, unless they're connected to the budget, they're unlikely to advance. Similar to how I reported a couple weeks ago, Government Relations reviewed every bill and has identified about 250 that will continue to monitor. Since my last report, I've added 5 new bills for your guys' review. In addition to the new bills on the key legislation report, I wanted to take a couple minutes this morning to quickly update the commission on the recent budget plan that Governor Ferguson released this past week. As I've reported to the commission before, this year's budget is particularly challenging due to the estimated somewhere between $8 and $15 billion budget gap. In response to this shortfall, Governor Ferguson presented a plan this last Thursday to address $4 billion of that gap through a series of spending cuts. The governor recommends pursuing this plan in conjunction with savings identified by former Governor Jay Inslee last year, bringing the total savings to about $7 billion, or about half the total shortfall. While Ferguson's plan should not be considered an official governor-requested budget, it does outline the priorities and strategies for how the new governor would like the legislature to address the budget problem. The key themes from Governor Ferguson's presentation were his commitment to maintain K-12 funding, public safety programs, investments in homelessness and housing assistance, and uphold recent collective bargaining agreements with state public employees. Governor Ferguson also focused on policies aimed at creating efficiencies and reducing state agency overhead. Additionally, the governor called for a review of programs that received significant increases during the COVID pandemic and recommended reduced spending for most of those accounts. While there is a history of working together, the legislature is technically not obligated to adhere to any of the governor's recommendations. And so at the end of the day, it will be budget writers who put something forward with the input from the governor. For the commission's reference, the next major budget milestone is the release of the state economic forecast in mid-March, which really just means that we're just beginning the major event of this legislative session, which is the budget fight. Pause there to see if there's any questions on the budget, but without any questions, without further ado, I'll jump into the legislation report. Questions?
No.
Great. So first up on a report is HB 1702, which would authorize counties to impose a privileged tax of up to 3% on a utility's gross income derived from the county's unincorporated areas. This bill would allow Snohomish and Island counties to apply this tax to all customers within their boundaries and provide a tax credit to the utility to cover the residents in incorporated cities. The bill was recently amended to further clarify that the tax would not apply to city residents and requires counties implementing the tax to earmark 0.2% to assist low-income customers with their utility bills. Snohomish PUD is engaging with the bill's sponsor to share our perspective that while we are sympathetic to the revenue challenges counties face and their desire to have parity with cities, we do want to ensure that our customer bills remain affordable.
A question on this bill.
So is this 0.2% of the, say they, let's say Snohomish County is 3, is it 0.2% or does the county get 2.8% and the program gets 0.2?
It's a very good question and we're still trying to find further clarifying aspects of that exact. Is it 0.2% of the 3% or is it just 0.2 total? We're trying to understand a little bit more.
Because the difference is phenomenal.
It could be different, exactly. We unfortunately don't have a great answer for you because again, we're trying to clarify a little bit.
Thank you.
Moreover, speaking of the recent amendment change, the bill now also sets up a point of friction potentially between utilities and counties on who should stand up and own and manage energy assistance programs. We're going to continue to monitor this bill and we'll engage our full delegation should the bill move to the floor for a vote.
I have a question. Is Snohomish PUD position, which means here is other, so what means significant that?
So we, again, we want to communicate to Bill's sponsor that we have concerns. We can understand and sympathize with kind of the intent behind this language, but again, want to ensure that they understand that there is an affordability crisis here in the state. And we, again, want to ensure that our customers' bills are as affordable as possible. So other gives us a little bit of flexibility.
Thank you.
So
I have another question. Does this apply to all utilities or just public utilities?
It applies to all utilities. So it's electric, water, gas, broadband.
Okay. I'm just thinking of Island County having us for Camino Island and IOU for Whidbey Island. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then to see how this program, the two-tenths of a percent of some number, would help different customers and how that'd be administered.
So it's a good question in terms of how it should be administered. I should mention that the public utility tax is, again, public utility. So, yeah, I'm not entirely sure it would apply to IOUs, but we can get back to you.
Okay.
And then I have a comment follow that is, do you have the opportunity to talk to other public facilities and see in what position they are in favor or not in favor about this bill and what is their thoughts about it? I'm intrigued about that. And I think it's a establish good conversations and see what opinion do they have about this.
Yeah, so we have been in touch with both Snohomish County as well as other utilities that this attack would apply to. As you can probably imagine, this has gone through several public hearings so far. The Washington Public Utility Association is certainly has concerns. Broadband, so you're talking about your Comcast Horizons as well as their trade association have also publicly indicated they've got concerns. We're in very good company with our utility peers and our position.
Thank you.
No problem. Next is HB 1253, which clarifies and expands how consumer-owned utilities may engage in joint use or limited liability agreements. The bill adds language to current statute allowing Washington utilities to engage in agreements with non-Washington regulated entities, which is most applicable to out-of-state electricity generation agreements.
Right, can you advance?
Oh, yeah, sorry, of course, my bad.
Sorry.
No, please. I want to make sure that we're on the right slide. This bill was introduced at the request of Seattle City Light. It has not undergone legislative action since it was last voted on the House floor on February 6th. I will note that no action is not a bad thing. They've just been focused on getting other bills out of the policy committees. So it's very much on a glide path towards passage. Next, HB 1237 died 2 weeks ago after the policy cutoff. While the bill failed to pass its policy or fiscal cutoff, it is worth noting that it could be revived as it could considerably be considered necessary to implement the budget, which means that the bill does not need to follow the traditional legislative timeline if it can be credibly tied to the budget or implement the budget. To simplify the key legislation report going forward, I plan to remove this bill from the next report, but may add it back depending upon if they revive it later in the session. Next is HB 1329, which clarifies the energy purchased under long-term contracts with the Bonneville Power Administration, also known as BPA, is excluded from the no-coal provisions of the Clean Energy Transformation Act, or also known as CETA. As a quick reminder, this bill is a priority of the power generation pool, which PUD is a member. The goal of the bill is to ensure that BPA's long-term preference contract do not violate CETA's no coal provisions. Currently, there's concern that the language in statute and CETA's no coal provisions is too vague regarding BPA's preference customer contracts. The bill is waiting a floor vote since February 4th and remains a high priority for the PUD. Next is HB 1522, and its Senate counterpart SB 5430, which creates a process for investor-owned utilities to submit their state-mandated wildfire mitigation plans to the Utilities and Transportation Commission for approval. Under current law, starting in 2024, all Washington electric utilities must develop wildfire mitigation plans and review, revise, and adopt those plans every 3 years. These plans are then submitted to the Department of Natural Resources and the Utility Wildfire Prevention and Advisory Committee. This bill would require IOUs to also file their wildfire mitigation plans with the Utilities and Transportation Commission, which would then approve, reject, or approve with conditions those plans. The PUD remains neutral on this proposal since it continues to only apply to IOUs. Both the House and Senate versions are awaiting for it. Next is HB 1610, which creates an exemption for the Public Records Act for critical infrastructure information. This bill defines critical infrastructure information to include details that could be used to threaten or compromise the PUD's physical or virtual infrastructure. As I mentioned in the last report, this was also amended to explicitly cover the PUD. The House version of the bill is now the only vehicle moving forward and is awaiting a floor vote as well.
I guess, you know, you read these repeatedly and finally something dawned on me. I cannot believe that this isn't already this is just telling me that our core operations, the records relating to how the system functions are public record. Is that what this is telling me now? You're looking up at the ceiling. If it isn't, then just say no, Tony, your face.
Yeah, there are certain exceptions now for disclosure. My understanding is this would make those broader.
Okay.
So this is like the location of where vital equipment is, so those that might want to do harm have a harder time finding it.
Yeah. Bulk electric system information is protected now.
Okay.
This is an expansion.
Exactly. It's the motivation mainly for this bill is actually on the cyber front, which, again, is newer to this area. In the process of expanding that, it also clarifies and, again, to Colin's point, expands some of the exemptions that are already available for physical. The next is HB 1804, which also, again, failed to pass this fiscal cutoff last Friday. This bill would have modified the existing Washington State University Community Solar Extension Program to make program funds more accessible, resulting in additional projects being built in Washington State. Well, it's unfortunate that this bill did not move forward at the session. The concept is likely to resurface in the future, and so you'll be hearing from me again on this one. Next is HB 1847, which after submitting this report was actually referred to a second fiscal committee on Friday, which means that it technically has died since it didn't pass the fiscal cutoff. However, again, as I kind of mentioned before, this could potentially be something to implement the budget. So we're going to continue to monitor it. The bill itself removed specific targets under the Clean Energy Transformation Act, which previously was a big problem for the PUD. Distributed energy priorities and community solars, which again was a big problem for this. The bill, as it currently prior to dying, was much more streamlined to just kind of be a mapping exercise for state agencies to figure out what their distributed energy priorities are. But again, we'll be removing this from the report. But again, want to ensure that you guys know that this could be revived again at some point.
It seems like in the amendments, it really is paper. It's not really, there's not much of a bill.
Again, I think the idea is to define what these distributed energy priorities are. This is kind of where the consensus was amongst the utilities and state agencies. Again, trying to find some pathway forward of where there could be work to be done. Much more narrow, though, in terms of its scope. Next is HB 1903, which would have established a statewide low-income energy assistance program within the Department of Commerce, funded by the Climate Commitment Act revenue. Similar to earlier bills we've also reported on, this failed to pass its fiscal cutoff and will no longer be considered for the 2025 session. We'll also remove this bill from the key legislation report going forward. Okay, now on to the newly added bills. First is Senate Bill 5627, which would update several components of the Underground Utility Damage Prevention Act, also known as DIG law. Washington law requires everyone, including businesses and residential property owners, to locate underground utilities before digging by calling 811. This bill would modify requirements related to locates and excavation of underground facilities such as water lines and buried electric infrastructure. More specifically, the bill modifies how and when certain notifications, like positive response, are required. Positive response, by the way, is when a locator positively responds back to an excavator ticket that the site has been worked. The bill also would update processes to incorporate new technologies, like a digital platform to mirror the 811 telephone process, as well as the bill would also, the bill is likely to also undergo additional revisions moving forward. The current draft reflects ongoing negotiations towards updating that statute. We're going to continue to engage with stakeholders as this bill moves forward, and we'll report back to the commission as it moves forward.
So you've got a comment in the lower left-hand corner. The PD is neutral on the bill because it's still expected to undergo additional changes. So are we in this process sort of hesitant to support or oppose a bill until it just gets flushed out where it's going to end up? Because
that's part of the process. I mean, as you know, our position is it's a little bit of an art and a science. With this bill specifically, we are both an excavator and a locator, and so we want to ensure that the provisions that are currently under negotiation would work for both sides. This, again, we're in the middle of actually those conversations right now, and what that looks like, and again, want to give ourselves a little bit of flexibility here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next, Senate Bill 5466 would establish a new independent state agency called the Washington Electric Transmission Authority, or WETA. The bill would authorize the agency to be a public resource and support the expansion of additional transmission in Washington State. The bill also attempts to address the slow siting and permitting process by amending the State Environmental Policy Act, also known as SEPA, to expand the categorical exemption statute to include transmission and distribution projects focused on updating, reconductoring, or enhancing the electric grid with grid-enhancing technologies that is already on distributed, disturbed land. The implementation, as you can probably imagine, is important for the details of this authority and could, as currently drafted, add another layer on already complex regional planning systems and potentially produce duplicate assessments. For the PUD, the expanded SEPA categorical exemptions would benefit us and would, if and when we ever need to go update any of our distribution lines. We understand that the current definition under the bill would apply to all our distribution lines that we currently see. The bill was voted out of the Senate Ways and Means Committee this past Friday, and will continue to move forward in the legislative process. This is likely to be kind of the main transmission bill that we see this year. And again, it's also expected to undergo additional revisions as it moves through the legislative process.
I have a comment about this and the context, and it keeps my attention. I don't know why. This, like, the new state authorities modeled after similar authorities in Colorado and New Mexico. So I'm just curious. I mean, there are similarities between those both states and Washington state, and similar things happen. So
Yes, correct. So the state of Colorado and New Mexico in the last couple of years have passed a very similar type of authority. There are going to be differences just in terms of how the legislation in Washington is drafted and the types of authorities that it is given. Those two states have just set up their authorities. We're still waiting to see kind of what those impacts have been. I believe Colorado has actually only done one assessment so far. But has not necessarily done a whole lot of activity, or there's not been any public activity on that front. But that said, as you can probably imagine, a lot of state policy is kind of looking at other states to see what potentially works. And this one was borrowed from those two states.
Okay, thank you.
I guess this is more of an observation. I always get a little queasy when I see another 9-member board of directors to act as a decision-making body of authority. I will not say anymore. To me, that's not very funny. I'm done.
Okay. Moving to HB 1409, which would modify the Clean Fuels Program under the Department of Ecology. The Clean Fuels Program was first established in Washington in 2021 with the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions for the transportation sector. The statute gives the Department of Ecology the authority to set a carbon intensity, also known as CI, standard for transportation fuel and requires all transportation fuel producers and importers to participate. Electric utilities can voluntarily participate in this program as well. Under current statute, fuel with a carbon intensity below the CI standard generates credits, while those with carbon intensities above the CI standard need to acquire credits to cover their compliance obligations. Currently, there is an oversupply of credits in the market, which has led to lower than expected credit prices. To counter the low credit price, this bill would allow the Department of Ecology to reduce the CI standard faster, thereby reducing the number of credits available on the market and increasing the price. The PUD, which participates in the Clean Fuel Program, would benefit from an increased credit price, which helps fund some of our customer programs eligible under the law. While increased credit prices would benefit the funding for our customer programs, there is a larger debate going on over the impact that the carbon intensity standard has on gas prices. Something to be aware of. The bill passed out of its fiscal committee this past week and is also waiting a floor vote. Next is House Bill 1871, which would require electric utilities with over 100,000 customers to create a residential battery energy storage program. Participating utilities would be required to provide a one-time incentive for the installation of battery storage for qualified customers through 2036. The bill would also require participating utilities to implement either a time of use rate or a virtual power plant to help increase customer savings. Similar to what occurred with HB 1847, the bill was referred to a second fiscal committee prior to the fiscal cutoff on Friday and didn't receive a hearing in time to pass the cutoff, so it again technically dead. While it's unlikely to move forward this year, it could again be considered necessary to implement the budget given its fiscal impact, so we will continue to monitor this bill going forward.
It mandates something that this board has the authority to do.
And so, again, we wanted to highlight that it does narrowly impact your guys' local control as a mandatory program.
Yeah, I mean, incentivizing batteries is like a great idea, but mandating that we have a program that we have a specific rate, that's really, really challenging. And, yeah, especially there's utilities that don't have the meters. Including us right now for a large percentage of our customers to even do the program.
Correct. I think there was a lot of conceptually stuff like in this bill. We were working with the sponsor as well as some of the other stakeholders specifically on the mandatory components of this, the idea of the rate design.
All these bills that, you know, we've been given the target and all the bills that try to help us achieve a target are frustrating in the sense, just let us understand our customers, our utility, and we'll make the target. Mandating how we go about it, what resources we use. And so, I mean, principally, if motivating people to put batteries is a great thing for us, but not this way. We would agree.
They are good ideas, but sometimes they don't apply with the reality that each UD asks or offered or do. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think again, there's interesting components within this bill, and we're excited to see what we might be able to pull out through the rest of this year and into the interim. What might be a workable, right, implementable bill? Because again, I think the idea of incentivizing batteries is something that we would support, but the details on how you implement it are important. All right. Last but not least, Senate Bill 5445, which would amend the Energy Independence Act, also known as EIA, to allow electric utilities more flexibility to meet the law's 15% renewable energy target. The EIA, enacted in 2006 after the passage of Initiative 937, requires utilities serving over 25,000 customers to obtain 15% of their electricity from renewable sources, purchase renewable energy credits, also known as RECs, to cover the compliance gap. Under the EIA, unfortunately, hydropower does not count towards that 15%, so many Washington electric utilities, at least under the definition of the EIA, are more than 100% renewable, are generated by over 100% renewable energy. This bill, requested by the Washington Public Utilities District Association, also known as PUDA, would expand the statute to include local energy resilience projects as eligible projects to help the utility meet the 15% energy target. local energy resilience projects would be redefined to include accelerated conservation as well as demand response. If this bill passes, Sonoma PUD would elevate, could evaluate additional opportunities to meet our EIA compliance, including using accelerated conservation and demand response programs, and would benefit PUD. The bill was voted on the committee, out of the committee, the fiscal committees on February 21st and awaits the board. And with that, any additional questions?
I have a question on that bill. So
yeah.
It sounds like there, if it passes, there's still a lot of work to do to figure out how much credit you get for a specific project. Has there been some conversations? Like if you do a demand response project or things like that?
There are ongoing conversations on exactly how to define what that looks like. And off the top of my head, I don't specifically know what it is, but I can find out.
No, it's fine. And then I guess I'm wondering, are we going to have to pay the auditor to certify the calculations like we have to do now for I-937?
That is a great question. And I
probably is the answer.
I would assume so that the state auditor would, but I can get back to you on that.
Well, let's see that.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you, Commissioner.
Sure.
All right. Excellent job, Ryan. Next up, we have an update on our South Everett Community Solar Project and Susie Oversby. Good morning, Susie and team.
Hello, I'm Susie Oversby, and I'm delighted to be here this morning. And nice to meet you, Commissioner, as well. Thank you. I work in our Energy Services Department, and it's been a couple of years since we presented on this project, and a lot has happened. And this is, I'm going to have a team slide here in a minute. This is Jason Cohn. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Jason Cohn. I'm with the Generation Group. I'm stationed out at Jackson, but help Susie out with this solar project as the construction project managers.
So we will, I'm going to cut to the, advance the slides here. So the purpose of this presentation today is to simply inform you of the status of the project. I'm not asking for any decisions or action. And I will cut to the chase. The project is fully constructed and generating kilowatt hours. So that said, anyone who's been involved with this project to date knows that as significant as that milestone is, it is one piece of a much larger project in our community. And an example of that is the official project name is El Sol al Alcance de Tus Manos, the sun at your fingertips. And that name came to us as a recommendation from someone who, from the community, who joined us at an open house a couple of years ago at the site as we were preparing the community for this project. The logo in the middle was developed or designed by Ruben Trebulio, who is an artist local to Everett and is engaged in this project. And then the hands and suns there, and then a couple more examples are right here, were painted by local school children. So we'll talk more about that. I'm going to highlight our project teams, dig in a little bit into the background. We'll talk about project construction, and if you have any questions about construction, Jason is here to handle those. We'll talk about community engagement, and then end with a slide on project financials and next steps. So it's always hard to put up a slide like this because this project had so many people working on it across the district, and I know I miss folks here. So anyway, but I do want to highlight our core team, the fine individuals in that picture there of the golden shovels. So we introduced Jason. Adam Lewis, also from Generation, oversaw a lot of our civil work. Kelsey Lewis, who's in Energy Services, spearheaded our community engagement. And I was lucky to nab her right as she started here at the utility several years ago. Leslie Moss is our grant coordinator on this project. She's right there. And if you don't already know her, you will, as we have a lot of grant activity right now. And then Jessica Spar, who oversaw a lot of our permit work, which was pretty hefty on this project. And one name I left off is Tom Olam, who's new, and he's in the back as well. Our accounting folks are a little shy. he is another grant coordinator new to the district and has a significant role that I will get to. We wouldn't have been successful without our contracting team, so Hargis and CG, who did engineering and design, our prime contractor was Granite Construction and Prime Electric and Primet Electric and Puget Sound Solar were subs on our project. We're transitioning the ownership of the asset to our energy storage and emerging technologies team, who will be overseeing operations and maintenance. And I will say that that team was also instrumental in consulting us as we designed and constructed the project. And they will be working with many departments across the district, as we already have in this transition phase. I want to call out City of Everett, our primary local partner. We are building did build the project on their property. Washington Department of Commerce and the WSU Energy Office, who committed significant funding to the project. So a little bit of background on kind of the objectives. So we were very intentional on where we sited this project, both from a community benefits perspective and a grid benefits perspective. So this project is in a very dense and urban environment, surrounded by a lot of multifamily housing. And that was important to us because we wanted it to be in a place where there wasn't already great opportunity for people to install solar on their homes. So just having kind of that connection with the community in that way. The project is 400 kilowatts and all of the generation credits are being directed to the Community Energy Fund to expand our emergency bill assistance in the community. And we're thinking that it will add about $25,000 annually to that fund. And the other piece of the siting for grid benefits, if I want to mention, is that this circuit that we put the project on is a summer peaking circuit, which is fairly unique in our service territory, at least at this moment. We're mostly winter peaking. So the solar resource matches really well with these circuits. I want to highlight St. Vincent de Paul. They are our one and only subscriber to this community solar project because they are the administrator of the Community Energy Fund. And then again, through our engagement activities, we have local artists and several community partners who have supported us.
Yeah, quick question. Oh, go ahead.
It's okay.
No, you have a question.
Where is located exactly in Latino?
Right next to Walfrey Hall Golf Course.
Okay.
Yeah. So, that's another benefit to this site. So, we've got the multifamily housing that I mentioned, but the park is really a destination for folks throughout Snohomish County. So, there's the golf course, there are ball fields that are always bustling on the weekends with kids' soccer games. And there's also what's a little bit newer is a skate park that's quite busy as well. So this the site just has a lot of opportunity for visibility and access to folks throughout Snohomish County. Although we're adjacent to the park, the project itself is located on the public works land. Those circles there are water towers. So we officially got started March 22nd last year, so almost a year ago, with our groundbreaking. Lots of community leaders and elected officials, including Commissioner Wilson and Logan. We had sparkling cider. And I want to point out on the picture on the right, the gentleman next to me is Ryan Sass, who's the Public Works Director of the City of Everett. He and his team were our champions in this project. I have a few pictures showing construction. We in we really got going right after that groundbreaking ceremony, but I'd say we in earnest started in the summer. That's when activity really picked up once the ground dried out. And Jason, do you recall how many holes were dug?
Oh, almost 1,000.
Okay, I was going to say hundreds, but 1,000 and how deep?
Yeah, they varied, depending on whether they're in the back or the front, but they're about 18 inches to anywhere from 18 inches in diameter to 2 feet for the ones in the back, and then 4 to 6 feet deep. So, and we, the area was consolidated fill, so there was construction debris and concrete, and a lot of challenges for the guys digging these holes. So,
so you didn't use the holes we dug at the groundbreaking.
No, we needed a bigger shovel.
I recall my hole was deeper than John's hole.
So in total, we installed 580 bifacial solar panels, which is a relatively new technology, but it's becoming more and more popular. The backside is reflective and captures reflection from the ground. So we're kind of excited about that.
So the backside gets reflection off the ground. So are we using a certain ground cover? That's...
No, we didn't really add that into our design. These panels just, they were significantly more expensive. They worked for our projects. We purchased them, but we didn't really plan for that. So that might be something, though, the emerging technologies team considers for the future. That,
but clever.
Yeah, yeah. So we placed the project in service in December, which is significant for tax purposes later on that I'll describe. And to date, we've generated about $2,100 in tax credits. Now, keep in mind, it's the dead of winter. And so that will greatly accelerate as the days get longer in the spring and summer. As I mentioned, community engagement through art has been a significant part of this project. So Kelsey Lewis has spearheaded that for us. Also in the blue jacket is Sherry Miller, another program manager in energy services who has supported that work. Our artists engaged in this project are Ruben Trujillo, who I mentioned, Luisiana Hernandez, and Jessica Marquez, and they're in those pictures. So they developed a curriculum in partnership with our education folks. And they took that curriculum into Horizon Elementary School, which is just down the street from the site. And they didn't intend to do this, but ended up going to every single classroom with this curriculum and this art project, engaging the kids, painting those hands and suns. And we have hundreds of those in Kelsey's cubicle now that will be hung on the fence. And they are also going to be incorporating the name of the project into this arts installation. So we kind of joked around that we had to get the project built in order for Kelsey to get this art project installed on the fence, because it's going to be really, I think it's going to be very cool, and hopefully a sense of pride and ownership for the community.
I had a chance to talk quite a bit with these artists, and really insightful, and they were into this project.
Yeah,
I'm really into it, and I was very impressed.
Yeah, they were very engaged.
Yeah.
It's fascinating talking to them. They're so excited to be working with students, and
yeah.
I'm glad that worked out.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see what they've come up with.
Me too. another piece of this that we maybe haven't talked about as much is a tree planting effort. So when we were developing the space, we had to remove 5 trees. And the City of Everett's guidance was that we replant 2 trees for every tree removed. So we committed to planting 10 trees after the project was built. Now, in the meantime, the city seized an opportunity, a funding opportunity, to build a pedestrian path that increases access for the surrounding community to the park. And the path just so happens to go past our project, which I think is very, very cool. Now, typically, I know we don't really like bringing people to our facilities, but in this case, I think it's a very good thing. This is not exactly what the path is going to look like, and it's just going to be one, but it just kind of gives you an idea of the layout a bit. We're working closely with Everett Parks on that, the tree species and the placement. And we are also, in addition to kind of designing to enhance the space for visitors and people on the path, going to be planting those trees as a buffer to folks who are practicing their golf skills and protecting the array.
So those trees look like they're on the west side. Are they going to be low enough and not going to shade the project? Or
yeah, what? Yeah, they're far enough away. And, okay. Yeah, please.
That. And in terms of protecting from those that are learning golf, have we experienced, because this is really, it's all pretty open. Have we experienced any issues with damages?
So we have. So the area at one point in time, quite a while ago, was a driving range. And so there's a golf netting that protects the water utility. Now that has been, even if we weren't building there, the golf course has said, you cannot be out here hitting balls towards the water utility. They heavily discourage that. However, there have been a couple of people, we have noticed golf balls, and we did have a couple of broken panels. We have since worked with the general manager at the golf course, who's installed, gosh, I think a dozen signs right around the practice area that I think are doing the trick. I mean, stating that the project is under surveillance. I want to knock on that, but the project's under surveillance. Do not be, you know, you are not allowed to be hitting balls there. So luckily we haven't had any incidents then, but there were some pretty old golfers out there while we were even constructing the project. So lastly, the planting right now it's tentative, but we're looking at that happening in spring of 2026 and hoping to coordinate that with Arbor Day. Okay, we've gotten to, I know this is like the fun slide for some folks, financials. total construction and engineering costs came to about $2.2 million. And we have funding committed from the Washington Energy Fund that's administered by the Department of Commerce and the Washington Community Solar Expansion Program administered by the WSU Energy Program. And between those two commitments, that comes to $1.3 million. Furthermore, we are, and this is where Tom comes in, we are gathering up all of our documentation and seeking outside counsel on applying for a federal investment tax credit. So this is new, relatively new for the utility. Prior to the Inflation Reduction Act, we weren't eligible as a nonprofit entity. So, we're learning. So that will be 30% of construction costs. We also last year applied to the U.S. Department of Energy. They have a low income communities bonus program, which is an additional 10% bonus on top of the 30%. We were approved, our application was approved through that program. So we now have an official IRS allocation, a letter that will include with our filing to the IRS. So that piece is tentative. It's kind of a moving target. I put in kind of an estimated value of about 800,000, hoping it's more, it could be a little bit less depending on kind of the details of allowable costs. But if that comes to fruition, we would be seeing the utility left with about 5% of the construction and engineering costs. If it doesn't, we still have the 1.3 million, which takes care of about 50%.
Is any of this currently on hold?
So the last,
or do we even know?
Well, the most information we received through some outside resources that Commerce directed us to. So they have a contract with a legal firm that we've been talking with, and they said that the IRS has continued to make payments on these credits as of mid-February at least. So yeah, fingers crossed for us. We're working to be thorough, but rapid. Getting that in.
Fast is good.
Yeah, I had a quick question on the financials. Who receives the benefits of the RECs?
Oh, we do. We receive those.
The utility does, or the program that's funding?
The utility will receive those from the RECs. Yeah.
Thank you.
So next steps, like I said, we're working hard to get the tax filing in. We continue to collaborate with the City of Everett on the tree planting. We're finalizing the art installation and then planning a community celebration for spring of 2026. Any questions?
And would that be something that the board would be involved in?
Absolutely.
Please pick a sunny day. any questions?
No, I have no questions, but this sounds a wonderful program. So are you going to replicate? That's an ambitious question, right? Because you are planning for 2026, but it is going to be another opportunity to partnership with other city or get more funds and replicate this solar, and solar alcance de tus manos in other cities as well.
Right. Yeah. Right now it's kind of an open question, but my hope is that we will. We get this question quite a bit from customers who want to participate. So we have another community solar project in Arlington that has over 500 of our customers who invested in that project. And so I think there's a desire for something along those lines again. So the only kind of certain funding opportunity I know of at this point, besides the federal tax credits, are the WSU program. And that funds low-income projects specifically, but what we can do is kind of use that and then customer investment perhaps to bring forward another project. So working also with the Energy Storage Group, kind of looking at opportunities to leverage storage and combine forces there. So lots of discussions, but no decisions yet.
Wasn't battery storage going to be a phase two of this, or am I mixing this up with another?
No, you're recalling that correctly, in that we had another grant through Commerce to do a feasibility study on adding battery storage. We had a number of feasibility studies for different storage projects, and that work actually led to the Tulalip microgrid work that the Energy Storage Group is working on. So we did not move forward with it on this project.
Okay.
Well, thank you. It's an exciting project. I can't wait to see the art and to be there for the ribbon cutting or whatever. And I'm glad that our new commissioner will be able to help me pronounce the name.
And I left some stickers for you.
Thank you.
Great job, Susie, and a huge congratulations to Susie, Jason, the entire team for getting it this far and up and running and generating electricity.
John, thank you for taking a short break.
Yes, please.
Okay. So it's 10:13, but it's
sorry,
Rob.
Sure. Ready to go.
That 10:20 sharp. Yeah. All right, it is 10:20, and we are back.
What do you have next for us,
John?
All right, we have Rob Beidler with our safety review for 2024. Morning, Rob.
Good morning. Morning, Commission. Rob Beidler, Senior Manager of Safety, Security, and Emergency Management. I was looking for control. So I think there's like maybe 10 slides here. We're going to talk a little bit about numbers. We don't do the work that we do strictly for numbers. They're kind of a byproduct of the work, right? But we would be remiss if we didn't talk about them and try to learn as much as we could about them. So looking back at 2024, this is our recordable injury rate. It is the recordable injuries in an equation that goes with the number of hours that we work. It's kind of the standard that we're judged by in a sense. So if you look at 2024, our recordable injury rate, these are recordable injuries that go into that rate. But there's good and bad about that. In those 5 years you look at, you see four numbers that start with a four. Those are the only four that we've had ever at the PUD. So the trend is good. But that also means that we sent 42 people home injured last year. And those are, you know, their families sent them to us one way. We sent them back another way. That's the number that we really, really, really want to go down. This is the actual rate. The 3.82 is the lowest recordable injury rate we've ever had at the PUD. That's the positive. The, let's just say, opportunity, as John and Amy like to call it, that needs to be closer to 2 to be industry average. Now, it's not a real fair comparison. It is and it isn't. Industry average is just in the neighborhood of 2, but some of those that we're compared to are like a nuclear generation facility that has mainly engineers, and their recordable injury rate every year is 0. So it's skewed a little bit. Nonetheless, that number we do need to drive down, and we continue. I'll talk about some of those efforts in the coming slides. This is a really important number. Our severity rate, it isn't just a recordable injury. It's how many days did they miss? How severe were those injuries? And I know I keep saying this in a positive and a not so positive, 5.35 is the lowest record, the lowest severity rate we've ever had. And the other part of that, every time we had one of those recordable injuries, we lost somebody for over 5 days. And again, impacting them, their families, their work teams. So when did we get injured? This is just a snapshot for you guys. You look at what I would expect is somebody would say, what on earth happened in April, Rob? How did we have 10 injuries in April? And there is no good answer. They were all over the map. We had a vehicle collision where a team was hit, not their fault. That was 2 injuries. We had 2 dog bites. We had a couple people cut their fingers with their knives. We had some strains and some pains. And so I don't have a good answer for that. That's just those are the months that we get hurt. How many times we got hurt in each month last year. What is getting us? Probably the only one there that you really needed a good explanation for, because it's not intuitive, is the hearing. That was the highest. So we have job classifications here that have high exposures to noise. And those people are monitored. And so we test their hearing. And if they hit a certain threshold in hearing loss, then it's recorded as a recordable injury. So when you see hearing, that is those people that have hit that threshold for hearing loss over the course of I would say careers, but it isn't always careers. Sometimes it's just years, depending on their job classification. Right now, I think we have 5 different job classifications out there that we routinely test their hearing.
Give me an example.
Some we have generation, you know, they're in power producing facilities and dams. Others that are maybe not as obvious might be transportation, using, you know, impact guns and all of those things that are noisy. So we've got about 5 of those classifications out there.
So how do we filter out the occupational part from what they might do in their private lives that didn't have a hearing, or do we?
Listen, Commissioner Logan, if you came up with a really, really, really good answer for that, then you could retire and probably make millions. We do the best that we can. We have a hearing protection program that is extensive, that people have fitted hearing molds for their ears. And I mean, we do the best that we possibly can, but can we differentiate between somebody that works in transportation and, you know, and puts 30,000 miles a year on their Harley, you know, with no hearing protection? No, we can't.
I guess where I was going is, can we help them check their hearing when they're not at work?
We absolutely do. We encourage, we train, we beg, we plead. Whether you're using a chainsaw or riding a motorcycle at home, we're pretty relentless about it.
Yeah, there is no way to distinguish between the two.
Sure.
But what we do as an employer is provide all the training, all the necessary hearing protection. We actually do tests on all the equipment. The noise levels that a line truck produce, a chainsaw produces, garage equipment, we test all of that. And we have mitigated, much of those noise exposures, but you cannot differentiate between what a person picks up or the hearing loss associated with potential work environment versus at home.
Where you see finger and hands, number two, we are not always as good as we could be with knives. And we do a lot of cutting, a lot of wire stripping, a lot of box opening, stuff like that. A new and renewed focus for us. And then you'll see shoulders and back, and you'll see a lot of strains and pulls. I'm happy to say that we now have a program manager in wellness. Her name's Jenny Harrington. Unbelievably skilled, and she is working with our teams all across the district in a lot of different ways. And one of them is to focus on those, not just physical health, but prevention.
What are the other categories?
So much. Okay. It is...
tripping over a file drawer. Well, we don't have any file drawers.
It's almost impossible to encompass. And so the 42 injuries, we just picked the ones where we got a high enough percentage that we could articulate. But we have over 1,200 people out there working hard every single day in every type of atmosphere you can think of. It could be anything from heat stroke, to a broken bone, to a trip and fall that turned catastrophic. You know, it could be, there's so many ones and twos that we just couldn't list them all.
I actually did a little bit of digging and chatted with Rob before this, because I noticed one of the questions for that other category. But knees, we had 6 knee injuries. We had 5 finger injuries. We also, one category is multiple body parts, which we had 7 injuries that actually affected multiple body parts. So we do a really good job of kind of spreading our injuries around to our body, which is all opportunities for us to continue to focus on the ways that we can prevent those injuries.
Causes, again, it is just to give you a snapshot. I certainly cannot cover all those here. I can answer any questions about them, but this gives you a good idea of the importance of somebody like Jenny and a program manager in that sense. When you look at strains, pulls, twisting, all of those things, those injuries are all preventable. The vast majority of the time it's preventable. In this industry, one thing that is, I'm newer to this industry, I think just over 5 years now. And I came from an industry where about half the injuries were not preventable. And here, I'm just guessing, but I would venture to guess that 90% of them are preventable. And so, which is an opportunity. If it's predictable, it's preventable. And so we're hoping that we can over time do better and better about that. This is the same thing. It just gives you a visual. That strains and tears. And some of the programs that we do have coming, that we're going to focus on in the future to mitigate those, get our people home. This is the only slide that I have about driving. I put miles driven because it's important to know that, like maybe during the time of COVID, we weren't driving as much. And so the one on the right, that's just miles driven per year. The one on the left, you see a huge change in 2022. It's important to know that we changed the way that we document and track vehicle collisions and incidents around that time. We're unbelievably thorough. Not that there was zero thoroughs before that, but now we partner with fleet. We partner with all the groups. We want to be sure and track and document everything that happens out there. If we don't know, we can't try to fix it.
And so those two lines you see are preventable collisions and backing collisions, there's no other way to describe it, but a renewed focus in 2025 to mitigate those numbers in so many different ways. So there's a couple slides here that there's so much to them. But this is just to give you what we did last year, what we're doing going forward, and to be honest with you, what your safety team does, you know, day in and day out for a living. So we developed a leadership safety training. For us to have a strong safety culture, we need our leaders in this organization to believe and be relentless in the pursuit of safety and injury prevention. And so last year, every leader in the organization went through a 2-hour leadership safety training that with John and I, and it was a discussion forum. And we talked about expectations. We talked about needs. We talked about the responsibility. And you guys, you know, not to put it all on you too, but so I got promoted and I raised my hand. I tested for it. I tried desperately to get this position, and then I got it. So congratulations, you know, I was given the awesome responsibility of trying to get people home every day. I signed up for it. I begged for it. I pleaded for it. They pay me for it. And so do most of the people in this room. They've all been promoted, a lot of them. John, the CEO, and our commission. That our charge, job one, value number one, is to get our people home every day. Now, when I say our people, I don't mean just our employees. The people we serve as well. It's everybody. Job one, that's what leadership safety training was all about. If you look in the upper right, you see We Power Safety. We had a kind of an off-the-shelf, you know, boxed up safety platform that we used for a lot of years here at the district. And it got us to a certain point. But then we needed something to fit us, something designed for us, something that met our needs and that we could sink our teeth into. So your safety team and some leaders around the organization put together the program, and it's on your mug. It's called We Power Safety. And again, that would be a 2-hour class to talk about what it does, but it is us, and it is who and what we are and how we get our people home every day, or at least try to. Each one of those slides, I could go on and on. So I'm just going to give you the high level. Again, this is what we've done, where we're going, and what your safety team does. You see the first one on the upper left. That's the lobby here. So we know that active threat is real in today's society. We like to call it active threat as opposed to active shooter, but it is active threat. So we train people in this organization what active threat is. The FBI tells us that it takes 5.5 minutes for somebody to call 911 in an active threat. 5.5 minutes, because people are scrambling, people are confused, people are hiding. So 5.5 minutes is eternity when something's going bad. So we put gunshot detection here, and it's also going to be in North County, and we're going to move it to our outer offices. Instead of 5.5 minutes, it's less than 10 seconds, and emergency services have been notified, along with the SOC, along with a select number of people in the ELT and security are notified immediately of what's occurring.
So is this a program, a system?
If you were to go out there, I could show you, they look just like a smoke detector.
Okay.
And it detects gunshots and sends a notification. And it's highly advanced. It tells you caliber, where it is in the building. If it's moving, it gives you all of that with almost 100% accuracy of whether it's a handgun or a rifle, how many shots and where they're coming from. And that immediately goes to our security department and 911. The Stop the Bleed, that is actually spreading around our industry, around the state. You are most likely to die from shock in a critical incident. And generally that shock is caused by loss of blood. So we now have tourniquets. We do it in our first aid training. They're stationed everywhere. They're in vehicles. People know how to use them and to apply them. And it may seem extreme, but it's a threat that we know exists. And that's what we do in safety. We have to, any opportunity we get, attack those things that we know are a danger to us. Fentanyl awareness. In the last couple of years, on the west side of Washington State, overdose, for the first time ever, has overcome traffic collisions and accidental deaths. For the first time.
We can't ignore that. We do fentanyl training. We actually do naloxone training. We partnered with the Stille tribe, and we have naloxone around the organization for people to apply, to use, and how to use it. And we have it in vehicles. We have it here at EB. We have it in all kinds of different locations. We can't ignore that threat. And I keep talking about training and programs. Last year and this year, your safety team will teach over 7,000 hours in training. Public education. I had a friend, his name's Ryan Gosman. He was one of my sergeants. And his wife and daughter were driving down the road and they saw a small fire. The daughter was 9. She stayed in the car. The wife grabbed her fire extinguisher, went to put it out, and she was electrocuted and killed. It arced. Well, public education, we don't know who we're going to save, but it's somebody. And those are our people. The last one I'll talk just a little bit about is leveraging technology. That thing that you see there, that trailer, that has cameras all over it, that has blue flashing lights, and it has a two-way communication so we can yell at people, like say, hey, you need to leave. We use those things routinely. We leverage that technology because at that location, we kept having people, let's just say, flop and camp. We had, human waste. We had syringes, drug paraphernalia. We used that technology and it completely eliminated it. It was gone. That threat was gone. And we do that. Right now, we've got 6 of those around the organization at different locations.
These mostly remote areas.
Yes, there was for a while. We had one right across the street here. They've moved now, but there was a residence that did a lot of trafficking and stolen property and some other activities we don't want to be part of. So we were losing things out of vehicles. There was damage. There was a lot of syringes, drug paraphernalia. We put that trailer up for in the neighborhood of 6 months and it eliminated it. And they've moved now. Energy Control Center, again, this is just one of those things where we just attack. Right now, we're working with North County Fire and 911. In November, and all the other one of our critical storms, critical incidents, there's massive communications breakdowns between us and emergency services. Things get lost in the shuffle. People don't know what's going on. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of people calling 911, some because their house is on fire and others because their power went out. And those are two different things. Right now, we're working on a program where during these events, we will have a 911 operator stationed with one of our operators in our facility. And so when we have one of our employees that gets in trouble, they get injured. And we did have a couple significant ones in this last event in November. Emergency services and radio can be dispatched immediately. There is no waiting. You won't even get through to 911 in some of those cases. And it goes the other way. When you have police officers or firefighters that are injured or trapped, or they have something significant and they can't get on the radio because it's so busy, they can't get help from PUD when they need it now. Now they have an operator there that they communicate on a radio and say, we need help right now. And then we're sending it. So this is a safety tool that I believe we will get across the finish line this year before storm season. And then we'll be able to tabletop to it. That might be new for some in the room, so surprise. Another piece of technology, we're getting close to the end. Another piece of technology, and it may seem insignificant. So we have telematics in all of our vehicles. And now in a lot of our vehicles, when they turn their overheads on, that Waze and Apple Maps and Chrysler's, you'll get a notification, utility work ahead. And now sometimes we close roads. You'll get a notification that says road closed ahead for utility work, and it reroutes traffic. During the storm was the first time we were out there closing roads, and it significantly decreased traffic, which decreases the danger to our employees and to the citizens. This is an older one from February of, I actually think this was last year, this particular picture. Now we're making
in the neighborhood of 30,000 notifications to drivers per month that there is utility work ahead. Please be careful. And this again,
we're generating that ourselves.
We are. As soon as that vehicle turns on its flashing lights, it is sending out that notification via Waze and all those other platforms. And this is another one that we've spearheaded and that's catching fire across our industry, that people are now trying to figure out who they need and what they need to do this. This is one of my most common phone calls right now.
You mean by catching fire becoming more popular right
now? It is becoming popular because they didn't know it existed. And once they're aware, then I give them the same speech I've given you. Once you're aware there's a problem and you can fix it, you are obligated. You signed up for it. This is one of those little things we do where we do social media. This is one of our employees' little ones, and this is actually Greg Ruiz. We take these pictures. We want people. What do you think the odds are if you're walking out to go to work one day and you're walking out the door and this poster is posted, and you think, okay, I got to get home to that. 1 in 100, 1 in 500. Well, the poster costs about 50 cents. I'll take those odds that has an impact. It may be a drop, but our philosophy and safety, that pursuit is enough drops makes a puddle, and you just keep working. This is this year's slogan for safety days, which we do, which I hope you can visit at our safety breakfast. So I got you. Done.
Well done, presentation.
Yeah, you bet.
I learned a lot.
Questions?
No, I'm really impressed with the presentation. Thank you. Safety is priority number one for every single one. And the safety culture, I wish that we can have the detection system for human behavior and the entry, right? We don't know. And people come in and see us. Oh, anyways,
thank you.
Thank you.
It's,
yeah, it could be a challenge.
I've got a couple of questions. So you showed your data with our long history rate of incidents and how it's down below. And I'm curious because I've always perceived, having originally come from an industry that was very focused on safety in the field, but not really focused in the office. So I know it can be challenging. The people in the field live and breathe it every day, tailgate conversations and those. Do we know how we're doing with office workers versus people that are in intrinsically dangerous positions? Do we know what our performance is looking like?
Yeah, I don't have a separation of those numbers. We do obviously know that they're substantially lower, but know that we do tackle both and we don't ignore either.
I know we tackle both.
Yeah. Not long ago, I won't even say when, I will just say that the most significant life-changing injury we had not long ago was a trip and fall from somebody that worked in an office, and it was catastrophic. It was a trip to Harborview, multiple surgeries, life altering. Oh. So those days, and then what did they trip on? They tripped on something 3/4 of an inch tall, and we fixed it, and it was gone. Yes, we would have loved to have fixed it, and then we would have never known we saved that person from that. But nonetheless, that's why we, no matter how small, we do what we can to fix it. But those dangers are everywhere. We talk about, just a quick example, we talk about people leaving the building. We talk about vegetation management so people can see. We talk about put your phone down when you walk out the door at night and it's dark, so you're looking around and looking at. We have security. Please have somebody walk you to your car, you know, so that it's endless what we can do as it relates to safety. And we do everything we can not to ignore any group of that.
One more question. So you're conversation about having 911 operator present in a storm reminds me of the challenge with having power lines down on the roads, and we can't be everywhere. Does local law enforcement help shut down the road the power lines across, or how? I mean, I know we deal with it when we get there, but what happens before we get there?
Yeah, and that's one of the driving forces behind this. So when a call goes during a storm goes into 911, they prioritize it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Fire will say, I have a priority one. I have lines down in the road. And we had 30 miles of lines down in the road, right, all over the place. And so that's not necessarily a priority one. Well, then they're getting themselves in a pickle. A priority one means that it's light, it's threatening to life. So they go to, they see power lines in the road, and then they say, this is a priority one. This is threatening life and limb. And then they drive away. And so it's problematic for them in their prioritization as well. So two things. Number one, we do high voltage training for emergency responders here in this county, which again, we're now starting to spread around the state because most don't do it. So we're doing exterior training. And then this, with direct communication to police and fire with 911 there, we can actually prioritize. I went during this last storm, I was in a meeting in the middle of the first night, 2 a.m., Department of Emergency Management, police, fire, you name it, everybody was there. And their priority was getting Westwick open just in case somebody, somebody needed to respond to a critical incident. And if you remember that storm, us opening a road just in case somebody needed something at some point was priority 10 for us because we had SR2 blocked. We had hospitals out of power. We had house fires. And so we need to fix that gap. And we believe that this will correct that gap.
I have a question. In the Energy Control Center, how many people were there?
Oh, man. I do not know those numbers. John, do you have an idea of how many would be there during that particular incident? Because we double staff.
I would say in the neighborhood of 8 to 10. And that would include actually a couple folks from our customer service group who could actually locate themselves in energy control to take calls once that we're more in kind of normal restoration mode. But we staff up operators and support staff beginning of the storm and then once they get into kind of main operation of restoration activities. So I'd say anywhere from 8 to 10.
And the hours they work is 24/7 or?
Yes.
Same or similar than 911?
Yes.
I asked that question. When I was a former city council, I was part of the, I was the liaison for the 911 for 1 year for the board. And it's really interesting. They start using the AI technology in order to answer in other languages. And they started testing last year and everything. So that's my second question about that. Do we have employees that are bilingual and multilingual there, or do we use AI too in order to answer whatever calls they receive for the
both? We have both bilingual and the help of language banks.
Thank you. Good to know.
Thank you for your presentation.
Okay, yep. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Excellent job.
Is that it for our study session?
It is.
Okay, next we have our general manager report, item 5. Give a report first.
I do. A couple items to share. First, from our HR group, the formal mentorship program held their kickoff, and this will be the third formal mentorship program or third session, kicked off February 20th with 20 new mentors and mentee pairings. Also, SuccessFactor onboarding 2.0 project kicked off on February 19th. The project team will be revamping the current onboarding process and experience for our new employees. Then HR and CorpCom teamed up last week. Human Resources and Business Readiness and Training teamed up to host graduation for the latest cohorts of the Foreman and Training Program. We had 9 total employees that had graduated through the Foreman and Training. These programs are a direct result of the fabulous work done by the Leadership Training Committee, a partnership between the union and management. A huge thanks to KJ Britton and Brenda Johns for hosting the event. Also from CorpCom, we recently hosted the first ever all-employee Between Two Squirrels virtually last week. 500 employees logged in and learned about SnowSmart, ConnectUp, the strategic plan, our trust initiative, and the latest DEI learning opportunity. This meeting is a direct result of feedback from the DEI blueprint and the employee engagement survey. The meeting is also recorded, so employees unable to attend live can catch up on the information later. This also supports our strategic priority number 5, which is focused on building Team PUD now and for the future. A huge kudos to Taylor Ostrander for being the MC and to the communications team for their hard work behind the scenes to get that stood up and initiated. Also, just a couple updates on things that I've had going on. Not last week, the week before, we had NWPPA executive and board meetings, executive committee and board meetings in Vancouver. And then last week, started with the APPA executive committee and board meetings, and then into the Ledge Rally last week, culminating with some Hill visits that Commissioner Logan and Commissioner Julieta Morano attended with us. I thought those went very well. The talk again is certainly around the impacts on the workforce cuts to BPA. But I think we are trying to play offense to the greatest degree we can. Again, I mentioned earlier this morning that Kim Johnson and team are working to put together a strategy for us and how do we best play in that space. But also last week, we got to meet and welcome our new federal government affairs person, Jenna Pesh, to our team. Got to hang out with her, and certainly glad to have her a part of the team now. And I see the smile on Kim's face having somebody to help her in all her work.
She's stationed in D.C. then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. At least for the first 6 months, is that correct, Kim?
Yeah.
And that's all. Happy to answer any questions. Any questions for Joe?
No.
Okay. Next, we have commission business, item 6, 6A, 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 6
You two ought to have a lot.
Yeah, well, I will start off and thank Kim and Allison for putting together our trip to D.C. for the legislative rally. And we're fortunate to meet with Representative Schreier of any enlargement. And I think we had some very meaningful conversations around Bonneville. It was very nice that John was there too and focused on the safety implications of what, you know, what could happen if Bonneville staffing gets so thin that they can't operate their basic systems or repair. So good conversations there. I look forward to doing it again next year. I hope that we can add the senators. We were unable to meet with our senators. Any other questions or comments and reports?
Well, I have a comment. Well, yes, I echo your comments, Commissioner C. Nogan, that was very nice to be in DC. And thank you, everyone, the team that put this together. And I was a lot to learn and visit the Hill and meet with the congressmen and the congresswomen as well. So that's really open line. And So in another note, I would like to ask commissioners for your support for Sunday, June 8th, I would like to assist to the pre-conference session, which is to take the class 101, the government's best practice and public power guidelines for the ABBA and national conference.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I've taken the class.
Yeah. You're taking it?
I've taken it.
You've taken it.
In the past tense. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, next we'll move on to 6B, our commissioner event calendar. This starts on page 119 of our packet. Are there any questions or changes to the event calendar?
Just noting, I'm doing virtual for PPC. I know there's a timing issue with putting this together.
Yeah.
And I believe also the new employee orientation.
Oh, I have it. Yeah.
I'm going to join by Zoom to those meetings too as well. Yes, the PBC. Yeah.
I am going in person. It just for me, it's just such a
Well, but also some pretty hot topics.
Huge topics. Yes. Yeah, I'd like to be there in person. Yeah, and I'm sorry that I missed the new employee orientation again. Next, item 6C, our 2025 district dashboard. This is starts on page 129 of the packet. Questions or comments on the dashboard?
I have none.
Like we just visited it last meeting, so
I will make one comment. Don't get used to seeing that green in our system reliability. This is another example of kind of what we've been talking about, adding a blue sky or a non-storm metric. With the storms that we had, what, a week-ish plus ago, those numbers will start to turn red. Again, the storm was significant, but not significant enough to reach what is considered a major event day and get excluded from those numbers. So that green is going to change quickly.
I didn't want to say anything because I don't want to jinx it.
Yes, well, it's too late.
Are there any questions, commissioners, about the dashboard? Okay. Next, 6D, our 2024 Treasury budget and project results for December. This is on page 132 of our pack. Questions or comments?
I have none.
You know, I have no comment. I just love the situational awareness this provides us. I know this is probably a lot of work to put together. I have to say, I really appreciate it. What's happening, where we sit, it's very helpful to me to not get excited at the end of the year when you do your budget. Thank you. Any comments, Bridget?
I have.
Okay. So next, move on to our governance planning calendar, item 7. Are there any changes to the governance planning calendar? Begins on page 146. Just a comment, we have our board retreat coming up.
Is that okay, Allison?
It's going to be about 8 to 3.
Okay.
And if you guys could just read the board policy before that date, that'd be really great, since refreshed in our mind.
Awesome.
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can you send that to us electronically? Yes. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Sounds like there's no changes. Is there any further business to come before the board? Hearing none, it is 10:59 and our meeting is adjourned.